Full reports are in the message buffer in your office, William said. I have reviewed them and believe they are suitable.
The captain looked briefly embarrassed. She'd been an XO until her promotion, William knew, and it would take time to break her of the habits of being an XO, including reviewing status reports in order to save the captain from having to do it herself. But at least she was well aware of her responsibilities to the crew.
Thank you, the captain said finally. And now I believe I should see the bridge.
Kat couldn't help feeling a little out of her depth as they rowed the intership car towards the bridge. Lightning was smaller than Thundris, the battlecruiser she'd served on as XO, but Thundris had been in service for several years before she'd assumed her post. The responsibilities of serving as a starship's first commanding officer were different, she knew, from merely taking over command from a previous captain. If nothing else, there was no prior history for her to study. Her XO was definitely older than she was, she knew. According to a very brief skim of his files through her implant, it was rude to access implants in polite company, let alone use them in conversation. He was old enough to be her father, maybe even her grandfather if he started early. That wasn't a surprise. Her real father was older still. But there was something about him that suggested age. He'd clearly not had the rejuvenation treatments from a very early age, she noted, instead deliberately trying to look old and distinguished. There wouldn't be anything wrong with his general fitness, she was sure, but he was mentally old. And he didn't seem to like her. Kat had grown up in a sheltered estate, but she wasn't naive. She had learned, from a very early age, that there were people who would suck up to her purely because of her family connections, while hiding their contempt behind bland smiles. One of the very few practical lessons Kat had had from her mother was how to determine what someone really felt about her, a harder task than it seemed. Anyone who was anyone on Tyre had implants to help disguise their emotions if they feared revealing more than they wanted in front of prying eyes. It took careful perception to tell when someone was trying to hide their feelings. And that, she had learned, suggested that they had something to hide. The XO seemed distrusting, almost disdainful. His attempt to hide it was good, but not good enough. Kat wondered, bitterly, just what he felt about her. Had he thought he would win command for himself? Or had he thought Kat was far too inexperienced to take command of a heavy cruiser? He would be right, she had to admit, if he thought the latter. She knew she wasn't ready to take command of anything larger than a destroyer, not yet. There was a ding as the hatch opened, revealing the bridge. Kat stopped and stared, allowing her gaze to move from station to station. The captain's chair sat in the center of the compartment, surrounded by a semi-translucent orbital display that showed the shipyard surrounding Lightning. Only half of the consoles were staffed, she noted, which didn't surprise her. No one expected to be attacked here, in the heart of the Commonwealth's defenses. Tyre was surrounded by enough firepower to make even fanatics think twice about risking an attack. But we can't take that for granted, she reminded herself. The Theocracy is a whole multi-star system of fanatics. Kat kept her face impassive as she took a closer look. Several of the unmanned consoles were clearly not installed yet, a handful of technicians working frantically to link them into the starship's data net. The private console beside the captain's chair was blank. It looked as though the bridge was far from ready for action. She made a mental note to review all the reports closely, despite knowing they should be left for the XO. She needed to know what was going on. Surprises, in the military, were rarely nice.
Captain on the bridge, the XO said.
There was a rustle as the crew stood and saluted. For a long moment, Kat enjoyed the sensation, knowing that she would never step onto her bridge for the first time again. And then she reached for the piece of paper in her uniform jacket, slowly pulling it out and unfurling it. That, too, she knew, was part of the ceremony. She couldn't take another step onto the bridge without asserting her authority. "Captain Catherine Falcone," she read. She had memorized the words already, but she had to appear to read from the parchment. "You are ordered to assume command of HMS Lightning and serve as her captain, Mistress Under God. Fail in this charge at your peril. By order of Grand Admiral Tobias Vaughn, First Space Lord." There was a long pause. She allowed the moment to stretch out, then turned to her XO. "Mr. XO," she said, "I assume command." The XO's face remained impassive.
"I stand relieved," he said.
Kat let out a long breath she hadn't realized she'd been holding. There was only ever one source of authority on board a starship, one person who held command. As long as he'd been the senior officer, William McElney had been the acknowledged commander of the starship, even once Kat had come on board. But now, she was the commanding officer. The final responsibility was hers. She felt the full weight of command settling around her shoulders and fought to keep her face impassive. Independent command was the ambition of every commissioned officer in the Navy, but it could also break her. The buck would stop with her. "Thank you," she said. "Please make a note in the log of the date and time I assumed command." He nodded, and then saluted. That too was tradition. Kat felt her cheeks heat up as a smattering of applause ran through the bridge. She took a breath. Some officers wrote speeches for when they assumed command. Kat hadn't bothered, as she had honestly never expected to be granted her own command for at least another 5 years, if she were lucky. Besides, the speeches had always struck her as pretentious. The crew would have more than enough opportunity to formulate an opinion of their commander without being forced to sit through a tedious address. "Return to your duties," she ordered. She watched them sit down, their backs a little straighter now they knew their captain was watching them. The memory of her first days as a commissioned officer warmed her as she walked over to the command chair, passing through the insubstantial hologram, and sat down. It felt good. Soft enough for her to relax, hard enough to ensure she wouldn't fall asleep. That wasn't a shooting offense, but any junior officer unlucky enough to fall asleep while on watch would rapidly start wishing it was. Her XO stood behind Kat as she touched her console with a finger, activating the system and linking directly into the starship's datanet. The automated command systems buzzed around her, displaying the Lightning's current location and plotting courses automatically to prospective destinations. Not, she knew, that she would trust the systems completely. One rule of AI was that true AIs always went insane shortly after being brought to life, and nothing lesser could hope to replace the human element from Starship Command. But without the automated systems, the ship's efficiency would be cut in half. She resisted the temptation to play with the system any further. Instead, she rose to her feet and passed command to the tactical officer, Lieutenant Commander Christopher John Roach. He was a young man, younger than she was, but a nasty scar ran down the left side of his face, and he'd chosen to shave his head completely as well. Kat made a mental note to review his file too, and then motioned for her XO to follow her into her ready room. Inside, she stopped dead. The compartment was dirty as hell, the deck covered in pieces of paper, data pads, and several coffee mugs. It didn't look remotely ready for any commanding officer.
"I've been using it as an office,"
the XO admitted.
"There was no time to clean up."
Kat felt an odd flash of irritation, which she forced down sharply. The XO was entirely correct. He needed to stay near the bridge and he needed an office, a place to work without disturbing the bridge crew. Using the ready room, her ready room, was the logical solution. But it still gnawed at her. Don't worry about it, she said.
She hesitated, then said what she knew she had to say.
Keep using it until we are ready for deployment.
I believe a steward has been assigned to you, the Exo said. She will clean the room once she arrives.
Cat nodded reluctantly.
A steward was something she'd managed to avoid, even though she was entitled to one as an aristocrat. But there was no point in declining one now.
She picked a pile of data pads off a chair, wondering why anyone needed so many, then placed them on the desk and sat down.
So, she said, once her Exo had found a place to sit, tell me about my starship.
Chapter 4
Come, Cat ordered as the door bleeped. She barely looked up from her datapad until she heard someone clearing his throat in front of her. The sound made her look up to see a short, bald man standing there, wearing the gray shipboard uniform of the Royal Marine Corps. Cat found herself smiling openly as she rose to her feet and walked around the desk to envelop him in a hug. It had been far too long since she'd seen her old friend and former lover.
It's good to see you again, she said, remembering when they'd first met.
Time and the Marine Corps have been good to you.
Captain Patrick James Davidson, he would be given a courtesy promotion to colonel while on board ship, hugged her back, then let her go. Cat understood, even though it hurt a little. They were no longer lovers, while he was, technically, her subordinate. Marines had a great deal of independence, but not from their starship's commander.
I was promoted, eventually, Davidson said.
He grinned toothily. One of his front teeth had been knocked out on deployment, and he'd never bothered to have it replaced.
They must have grown sick of scraping the barrel for officers to promote ahead of me.
Something always rises to the top, Cat agreed. She walked back to the table and sat down, then smiled at him. Thank you for accepting this posting.
It was a choice between this ship or another hell world, Davidson said.
He suddenly stood to attention.
Colonel Patrick James Davidson and crew reporting for duty, Captain.
Welcome on board, Cat said, dryly. She waved at the seat behind him. Take a seat, Pat, and put off the formality. Davidson sat, but still remained ramrod straight. Cat smiled to herself. Even when they'd been on shore leave, free of all other demands on their time, he had been unmistakably a Marine. She had half expected him to loosen up with the promotion and added responsibility, but he still seemed as tough and determined as ever. But then, Marines were only ever promoted from the ranks. None of them graduated from OCS without experience as an infantryman first.
It's been years, she said. What have you been doing? Spent a great deal of time on McKinnon's world, Davidson said. The locals voted for annexation and they're generally happy, but there's a small bunch of resistors who have been making everyone else miserable. They could have had an island of their own if that was what they wanted, but instead they started to attack settlements and so-called collaborators.
Cat nodded, unsurprised. And you managed to hunt them down?
Gave them a damn good thrashing, the one time they fought a pitched battle, Davidson said. We ensured the local security forces got enough breathing space to make certain they had time to rebuild, train, and take the offensive. But it will be years before all support for the insurgents fades away into nothingness.
He shrugged and then met her eyes.
Did you pull strings to get me on board?
Cat didn't want to admit to anything, but she knew she couldn't lie to him.
My father pulled strings, she admitted. Far too many strings. I was due to assume command of a company anyway, Davidson assured her. I'm not too disappointed by the way things have turned out.
And few people know we were lovers, Cat thought.
None of the crew from HMS Thomas had been assigned to Lightning. As far as anyone knew, she and Davidson might have crossed paths, but they were hardly close.
but if someone had good reason to think strings had been pulled, they might deduce the truth. And then who knew what they would think? She looked up, meeting his eyes. Can we talk freely?
Of course,
Davidson said. Cat nodded. Captains couldn't talk to anyone about their doubts or fears, not when it was important never to show weakness in front of their junior officers. The only person on the ship who came close to them in terms of authority and position was the Marine commander, who had similar tasks and responsibilities. They could talk to each other openly, if they developed a good working relationship. By that standard, she knew, Davidson and herself were probably far too close. They'd been lovers, after all. He'd seen her naked and vulnerable. He wouldn't put her on a pedestal. I don't think some of my officers like or trust me, she said, reluctantly. It had taken her time to unbend enough to really talk to new friends once she'd joined the Navy. Back home, anything said was almost certain to be used against her at some later date. And I feel overwhelmed. She waved a hand at the data pads on the desk. 3 days after her arrival, the compartment had been cleaned, but there were still an enormous amount of files to read and paperwork to sign. Normally, a commanding officer would have much more lead time before assuming her post, enough time to read the files for herself and decide how she wanted to proceed. Kat had the uncomfortable feeling that she was falling behind, no matter what she did. It was one hell of a struggle to force herself to read just one more file, and then another, and then another. You are young for your post, Davidson pointed out. His eyes sharpened. Did you pull strings to gain promotion? My father did, Kat said. She'd liked Davidson from the start because he'd never treated her any differently, even after learning who her father was. But then, Marines from the aristocracy tended to assume false names when they entered boot camp. Everyone started at the bottom and worked their way up. He has concerns. She hadn't really wanted to talk about it, but the whole story came tumbling out. Davidson listened, carefully, as she outlined her father's fears, then the steps he was taking to try to obtain some hard data. By the time she was finished, Davidson was frowning, an expression she knew meant trouble. He'd only looked like that once before in her presence, after one of his fellow Marines had screwed up badly. It was a fearsome sight. I have heard rumors through Marine intelligence that things are not good along the border, he said slowly. But only rumors. Kat felt her eyes narrow. The Marine Corps had a separate intelligence section, something that irked both the Office of Naval Intelligence and the Civilian External Intelligence Agency. It was normally geared around local intelligence collection to support Marine deployments, but it did tend to collect tactical and strategic intelligence as well. Sometimes, it even picked up on something the larger intelligence services had missed. I see, she said carefully. What did they say? Nothing concrete, Davidson admitted. Mostly there were concerns about the growing insurgency on Cadiz, and the certainty that something is supplying the insurgents with heavy weapons from off-world. The wretched planet is sucking in too many of our cadre from the Marines, not to mention the Army and forces from Commonwealth planets. Hell, the latter are growing increasingly reluctant to send any further forces to Cadiz, citing the Commonwealth Charter. Overall, Marine intelligence thinks that Cadiz isn't the only world that has received attention from the theocracy. Those missionaries might have done more than try to spread the good word. Kat grimaced. The Commonwealth had total religious freedom and total separation of church and state. There had been no choice. The Commonwealth couldn't afford to exclude potential member states because of their religions, as long as they adhered to the Commonwealth Charter. If someone wanted to worship Satan or accept a subordinate position because of gender, there was no law prohibiting it, which made it hard to deal with missionaries from the theocracy. Kat suspected, and she knew that most of her fellow officers shared her suspicions, that the missionaries were nothing more than spies. But they couldn't be barred from any member planet, not without breaking the Commonwealth's laws. All the intelligence services could do was keep an eye on them and watch for signs they had something else in mind. All along the border, she mused. And those insurgent groups might be receiving help, too.
Not on the same scale as Cadiz, Davidson said. But every other world voted for annexation. Cadiz did not.
And that, Kat knew, was the core of the political struggle that had deadlocked the Houses of Parliament. Cadiz had been, for all intents and purposes, invaded and conquered, without even the benefit of a great many people willing to welcome the Commonwealth. Peace was needed to start investments on the surface, investments that would pay off handsomely in the long run. But the locals weren't interested in peace. All they wanted was to get the outsiders off their world, which would leave them hopelessly vulnerable when the theocracy came calling. Other resistance groups could be handled. They could be fended off until the newly annexed world was ready to take responsibility for its own security, and the economic boom undermined whatever support the resistance had from the population. But Cadiz. Kat suspected that there were members of Parliament who would vote for unilateral withdrawal tomorrow if the issue were put to a vote. And that would be costly, too. Davidson cleared his throat.
It does look like war is looming, he said. Many of the readiness reports from Cadiz are not good, either.
Kat looked up at him sharply. You have evidence?
Just funny little reports from marine detachments, Davidson said. You do realize that there are very few bootnecks on 7th Fleet.
Kat blinked. Davidson commanded a full company of Marines, 100 in all. A super dreadnought rated at least 4 companies of Marines. In total, Admiral Morrison should have had around 3,000 Marines assigned to his fleet. Marines didn't just kill people and break things. They served as everything from shipboard police to damage control officers and emergency manpower.
They've been assigned to the planet largely, Davidson explained, answering her unspoken question. The report wasn't too clear, but it looks as though the only ships that still have marine complements are starships on escort or border patrol duty. Now, what does that tell us about the situation on the ground?
That it's poor, Kat said. It wasn't a guess. The Commonwealth had assigned nearly 1 million soldiers and marines to Cadiz, but they were garrisoning an entire planet. If they needed to strip marines from their starships, she suspected, the local commander clearly felt he needed them. And that there's hardly anyone to provide support services for the fleet. She looked down at the desk. Who's providing onboard security?
Shore patrol, I suspect, Davidson said. If there's anyone providing it at all.
Kat fought down the urge to start screaming. The shore patrol was universally loathed among spacers, being neither spacers themselves nor civilian law enforcement. Their normal role was nothing more than patrolling spaceports, pulling drunken spacers out of bars, and providing first responders for certain emergencies. It was far from uncommon for isolated shore patrolmen to be beaten by drunken spacers, who would then slip away to their starships and swear innocence when the senior chiefs demanded answers. If shore patrolmen were providing boarding parties... She shook her head in disbelief. Boarding a starship, even if the crew had surrendered, was a tricky job at the best of times. The shore patrol weren't even trained as junior crewmen, let alone experienced spacers. There was a reason such tasks were normally left to the Marines.
I think that's something that should be relayed to my father, she said, although she wasn't sure what, if anything, could be done with it. Any half-decent PR flack could come up with a dozen excuses that would sound plausible, at least to a civilian.
But, she looked up, meeting his gray eyes. I don't think my exo trusts me.
So you said, Davidson replied. You must be rattled. It's not like you to jump around.
Kat nodded wordlessly. He knew her well. Davidson placed his hands on her table, then leaned forward.
You are too young and too inexperienced to be formally assigned command of this ship, he said. Your XO and your other officers will be aware of it. As your family name is rather well known,
Kat snorted rudely. There wasn't a person in the Commonwealth who hadn't heard of the Falcone family.
They will suspect that strings were pulled to get you command, Davidson continued.
He paused significantly.
No. They will know that strings were pulled to get you command. A command you didn't earn. They will be very worried about your competence, and well, they should be. For all they know, your previous successes came about because of your family name, too.
They should have seen me at Piker's Peak, Kat said ruefully. I didn't flunk out, but I didn't exactly win any awards.
I don't think that would reassure them, Davidson said. Whenever someone new takes command, even in the Marines, there is a period when everything is out of shape and nothing feels quite right. No one quite trusts the newcomer, particularly if they haven't served with her or him before. Hell, things change even when the new CO is promoted from the ranks of those already serving within the unit. In your case, it's worse because you have far less experience than anyone else.
Kat nodded. Even a Marine who was promoted as soon as it was legally possible would have the experience of being an infantryman, she mused. I didn't come up from the ranks.
No. You didn't, Davidson said. And your XO did. I don't blame him for having a chip on his shoulder.
I know, Kat said. She'd reviewed personnel files until she'd felt her eyes glazing over, starting with William McElney. He wasn't even born as a Commonwealth citizen.
That's a problem that will probably come back to bite us, Davidson said. We treat people like him as second-class citizens, no matter their competence.
Kat sighed, remembering lessons from a series of tutors. The idea of creating the Commonwealth had caused an almighty struggle in the Houses of Parliament, with some families contemplating a whole new series of markets for their goods, while others feared the dilution of their power base in the wake of an influx of newcomers. In the end, a compromise had been hammered out, ensuring the current balance of power was maintained while the newcomers were allowed to enter the aristocracy. Given time, the projections had maintained, the newcomers would become part of high society.
They might be right, she thought. But that does no good for anyone born before their world joined the Commonwealth. They'll never rise as high as they could.
My advice, Davidson said, is to be the best captain you can be.
Kat glowered at him. And I couldn't have thought of that for myself?
Sometimes the only way out is through, Davidson said, unabashed. You will have to work hard to convince them that you deserved to be promoted. Think of yourself as a version of LaBelle Jones.
Oh, Kat said. Her lips twitched, humorlessly. That isn't the most reassuring thing you could say. She remembered. The story had been taught at Piker's Peak as a cautionary tale, although no one had been quite sure if it was a warning about the dangers of favoritism or how people could jump to the wrong conclusions. A young officer, assigned to a remote station, had been promoted several times, simply because the bureaucracy insisted that someone higher in rank had to be in command. But when the screw-up had finally been noticed by the Inspectorate General, no one had been willing to believe it was just a clerical error. The poor officer's next set of superiors had assumed the worst, that she'd been the beneficiary of an absurd degree of favoritism, and piled work on her until she'd nearly collapsed.
I'm not trying to be reassuring, Davidson said. I'm trying to tell you that earning the respect and trust of your subordinates isn't going to be easy.
I know, Kat said. She looked down at her hands for a long moment and then looked up.
And how are your Marines?
Settling in, Davidson said.
We would like the use of the main corridor, if you don't mind.
Once it's clear of junk, Kat said. At least the crew was making rapid progress now. And, she shook her head, dismissing the thought. Part of her had wanted to ask if he was seeing someone. His file had said he wasn't married, but Marines rarely married until they left the service or became combat lifers. But he might still have a girlfriend on Tyre, or one of the other ships. God knew she hadn't exactly been chased since they'd split up and gone their separate ways. "I'll expect you to handle your men," she said instead. Their relationship could never be the same, no matter what she wanted. And she was being stupid even considering the possibility, not when she was his commanding officer. "And I'll see you at dinner tonight." Davidson lifted an eyebrow. "Dinner?" Kat smirked, but then tried to hide it. Perhaps he'd had the same thought, too. "You're the last officer to board the ship," she said instead. "I was waiting for you before hosting a formal dinner."
"I look forward to it," Davidson said stiffly. He rose to his feet. "With your permission, Captain, I will return to Marine Country. I have training exercises to plan."
"Me too," Kat said. They couldn't fly into battle. Not yet. But they could run exercises to make sure they made all the obvious mistakes before actually facing a real enemy. "I'll see you tonight." She watched him go, then turned back to her terminal, feeling an odd tinge of regret. She missed what they'd shared, more than she cared to admit. But at least, she told herself firmly, there was one person she could trust on her ship. Chapter 5. All things considered, Commander William McElney conceded reluctantly, it could have been worse. The captain was inexperienced, at least when it came to being a commanding officer. She had a tendency to do too much of the work that should have been left to her XO, a common trait in newly promoted captains. But at least she wasn't a tyrant, or a whiny brat in a naval uniform. He'd served under both kinds of commanding officers in his long career. But he was still worried about the first time Lightning went into battle. Who knew how the captain would react? He pushed the thought to one side as he stepped into the conference room and glanced around the table, silently gratified to note that all of the senior officers had made it. They'd spent the last 2 days finalizing preparations for departure, something that had worn them out and made him urge the captain to ensure that they had a day or two of rest before they actually departed the system. There was no time for shore leave, even to the orbital intercourse and intoxication station, but at least they could have stood down for a day. But the captain had warned that it would depend on their orders from the Admiralty. The conference room seemed smaller than he remembered, now that it was actually serving its designated role. A large holographic image of the starship hung over the table, which was surrounded by comfortable chairs and a handful of consoles. A coffee maker sat against one bulkhead, with several officers glancing wistfully towards the machine. William sighed, and then motioned for the steward to begin serving coffee. There were days when he knew the Navy practically ran on coffee. He took his seat, beside the captain's chair at the head of the table, and waited. Captain Falcone entered the compartment moments later. She looked tired, but happy, he noted, as he rose to his feet in greeting. Somehow, actually working so closely with her made it easier to ignore the fact she looked too young to be on a starship, let alone sitting in the command chair. He had a feeling, judging from her expression, that the Admiralty had finally gotten around to cutting the starship her orders. No captain, not even the most rule-abiding commanding officer, would be entirely happy drifting in orbit near Tyre. It would be far too easy for the Admiralty to interfere with the smooth running of their starship. He sighed at the thought. The new crewmen had arrived, as promised, and some of them were going to be trouble. He would have rejected them if there had been time, but the missives from the Admiralty insisting that they move up their departure date had grown more frequent and more ominous. Instead, All he could do was ride herd on the potential troublemakers and make sure the senior chiefs did the same. It was possible that careful supervision would turn them into valuable crewmen, or at least keep them out of trouble. "Please be seated," the captain said, as she took her seat at the end of the table. There was a rustle as the officer sat down, then a pause as the steward served the captain a mug of coffee. "I would like to start by saying that you have all worked very hard to prepare this ship for departure, and I am very proud of you."
"You would like to say?" William thought, dryly.
He dismissed the thought a moment later. He'd had some commanding officers who indulged themselves with word games, but Captain Falcombe didn't seem to be one of them. Instead, it was just a clumsy choice of words. "We have finally received our orders from the Admiralty," Captain Falcone continued. "We will be departing for Cadiz in 2 days. Unfortunately, we will also be escorting a convoy of 9 civilian merchantmen. It will not be an easy task." That was an understatement, William knew. Merchantmen didn't tend to have the inherent flexibility of military starships, not when their contracts specified that deliveries had to be made by a specific date or penalty clauses would come into effect. One of the bigger shipping firms would hardly be inconvenienced by having to pay out compensation for late delivery, but it could literally ruin a smaller firm, or an independent shipper. Indeed, he would have expected the latter to run through hyperspace on their own, relying on the energy storms to cloak their presence. The holographic image changed. This time it showed 9 bulk freighters, all Rhesus class. The Rhesus was an old design, dating all the way back to the era before the Breakaway Wars, but it was known for being reliable and, more importantly, easy to refurbish as technology grew more advanced. William would have bet half his monthly paycheck that none of the freighters in the convoy still had anything from their original configuration, apart from their hulls. Even civilian-grade sensors had advanced immensely since the days of the UN. "It's 4 weeks to Cadiz," the captain continued. "During that time, we will both be handling escort duties and running constant exercises. It is my intention to have this ship ready for battle by the time we arrive at Cadiz. We do not know when war will break out, but it will. We have to be ready." William couldn't disagree. Scuttlebutt around the fleet suggested the Admiralty expected war to break out within the year, although cynics wondered if the whole collection of rumors was an attempt to justify the latest military budget as it fought its way through Parliament. It was true enough that the Royal Navy had claimed a larger share of the budget ever since the Commonwealth had come into existence, but it didn't take super dreadnoughts to provide convoy protection and hunt down pirate bases. That was a task for frigates or destroyers.
"The latest weather reports suggest the presence of a storm moving towards us in hyperspace," Lieutenant Nicola Robertson said. The navigator looked uncommonly nervous, although that wasn't too surprising. Predicting the course and duration of energy storms in hyperspace was more a matter of lucky guessing and consulting tea leaves rather than good, reliable science.
"We may have to add an extra week to our journey to avoid brushing up against its edges." William held his breath, wondering how Cat would respond. Some captains would have understood the point. Others would have snapped at the impudent officer who had dared to question their arrangements. Which one, he asked himself, was Captain Falcone? "Better to take a week longer to reach our destination than try to fly through a storm," Captain Falcone said simply. She gave Lieutenant Robertson a reassuring smile. "I would prefer not to test the ship's hull that violently."
Thank God, William thought.
In theory, a low-level storm could be navigated through as easily as an air car would fly through turbulence in a planetary atmosphere. But in practice, hardly anyone would take the risk if it could be avoided. And a high-level storm would rip the ship apart so thoroughly that no one would ever find any wreckage, not even a few stray atoms. Captain Falcone, at least, understood the basic realities of travel through hyperspace, unlike some of William's former commanding officers. They had seemed to think that their will bent the laws of time and space themselves, He nodded at Nicola, who looked relieved. She was young. Like most navigators, she had learned her trade at Bendix Base rather than Piker's Peak, and had little grasp of military formality. Technically, she wasn't even in the line of command. William had a private suspicion that her informality would get her into trouble one day, although he intended to ensure it didn't happen on his watch, and she was pretty enough to get into a different kind of trouble on shore leave. Lieutenant Commander Roach cleared his throat. "Captain," he said carefully, "are any other warships being assigned to the convoy?" The captain's face darkened. "No," she said. "The freighters have a handful of weapons mounts apiece, but we're the only true warship." William nodded to himself in approval. Captain Falcone understood the implications. Judging from the level of communications traffic between Lightning and Naval HQ, she'd also tried to argue with her superiors, requesting additional support. But she'd clearly failed. Roach put it into words. "Captain," he said, "we can't guarantee security for 9 freighters in hyperspace." "I know," the captain said, her mouth twisted as though she had bitten into a lemon. "We might lose one of our ships in a distortion zone and never realize it." She was right, William knew. Hyperspace played merry hell with sensors, particularly long-range sensors. It was quite possible for a pirate ship to shadow the convoy, satisfy itself that it could pick off one of the freighters, then attack during an energy distortion that would make it impossible to tell that something had gone wrong. It would be hours before the freighter failed to check in, at which point it would be countless light years away, being looted by the pirates. The crew would be in for a fate worse than death. He rather doubted their weapons would make any difference. The big corporations could afford weapons licenses, cramming as many armaments into their freighter hulls as they liked, but it wouldn't make them effective warships. Freighters wallowed like pigs in mud, their sensors and shields rarely military-grade. Hell, there were restrictions on selling military-grade technology to civilians, even for the big corporations. There was just too great a chance of it falling into very unfriendly hands. And it was starting to look as though someone had set the captain up to fail. "We cannot hope to hide the convoy," Captain Falcone said. "The scheduled departure date cannot be put back any further. Anyone with eyes on the system will be able to track our numbers, course, and speed, then make a rough estimate of our location. And 10 ships are easier to locate in hyperspace than one." She took a breath. It was easy to see she was nervous. "I plan to turn our weakness into a strength," she continued. "Standard doctrine places the escorting warship at the prow of the convoy. I intend to place us at the rear. We will pose as a freighter." There was a long pause. No one spoke. William evaluated it rapidly. It was risky, he had to admit. If they ran into an ambush, the first freighters would be hammered before Lightning even realized they were under attack. But few pirates would dare to take on a heavy cruiser, even if they thought they had the firepower advantage. And few pirate groups had anything larger than a frigate under their command. It was much more likely that they would try to pick off the freighter at the rear of the convoy, rather than challenge a warship directly. And, if the captain's plan worked, they would run right into a heavy cruiser instead. "Workable," William said. "Do you intend to use drones to ensure that any observers see us at the prow of the convoy?" "One of the freighters carries a modified electronic countermeasures package," the captain said briskly. "Mother's Milk will pose as Lightning. She wouldn't fool anyone in normal space, but in hyperspace, sensors are unreliable enough to create reasonable doubt." She smiled coldly. "Maybe next time we can have all the freighters posing as warships," she added. "Make them guess which of us is the real contender."
"The odds would favor them," William pointed out.
"We could run a pair of drones forward if we mounted a control station on Mother's Milk," Roach offered.
Their sensors would give us some additional warning if anyone took up position in front of us.
Costly, William pointed out. Drones configured to work in hyperspace cost a cool 5 million crowns apiece.
The bean counters would be furious, even if the drones were recovered and recycled.
They might garnish your wages to pay for them.
But worthwhile, Captain Falcone said. See to it.
William made a note of it on his terminal, thinking hard. The captain was from an aristocratic family. She would, if the scandal pages were accurate, have a trust fund, a share in the family's wealth for her to use as she pleased. Was hers large enough to afford a 5 million crown drone? It was unlikely she needed her monthly paycheck to live a life of reasonable luxury. He felt a flicker of envy. Growing up on Hebrides had been far from easy. If his brother hadn't... He shook his head, forcing the thought to one side. Memories of his brother and what he'd done to feed the family still brought stabs of pain and guilt. 30 years in the Royal Navy had never quite healed the scars.
We could also follow a more evasive course, Lieutenant Robertson suggested. If we went off the normal shipping lines.
Too great a risk of losing one of the freighters, the captain said. So quickly that it was clear she'd already considered the possibility. We couldn't take that chance.
They would have real problems picking up the navigational beacons, William agreed. Not every ship has a skilled navigator.
Robertson blushed, as he'd hoped she would, rather than looking crushed.
The captain cleared her throat. I will not shed any tears for a destroyed raider, she said firmly. However, I intend to capture a raider intact, if possible, along with her crew. I have, her face twisted in disgust, authority to offer them life on a penal world if they surrender once we have them at gunpoint.
William shared her feelings.
Pirates were the scum of the universe as far as any naval officer was concerned, and the Royal Navy had legal authority to simply execute captured pirates on the spot. In some ways, it was counterproductive. There was rarely any attempt to interrogate prisoners before shoving them out the airlock. But few pirates actually knew anything useful. Their senior officers, well aware of what fate awaited them, often fought to the death.
There has been a considerable upsurge in raider activity recently, Captain Falcone continued, before anyone could muster an objection. We need to know if a foreign power...
There could be no doubt which one she meant. Has been supporting the raiders for reasons of their own. Prisoners may be the only way to obtain hard evidence. There was a long silence. Roach finally broke it.
Captain, he said, what will happen to the prisoners if they're not going to be spaced?
They will be held in the brig, then transported to Nightmare, the captain said flatly. Once they're on the surface, they can work or die.
Roach looked pleased, William noted.
Nightmare was a marginally habitable planet, its original settlers fighting a losing battle to survive when they'd been rediscovered. The Commonwealth had transported most of the settlers to another world, then turned Nightmare into a penal colony. It was possible that the prisoners could master their new world, the government had argued at the time, eventually creating another member world for the Commonwealth. And if they killed each other there... Well, they wouldn't be hurting innocents. Everyone who was exiled to Nightmare thoroughly deserved it. The captain gave them a moment to assimilate what she'd said, then went on.
We will take tomorrow as downtime, she said, then prepare for departure. There's no time for shore leave, I'm afraid, but there will be reduced duty hours for almost all of the crew.
Please don't overindulge in the still I'm not supposed to know about. William concealed his amusement with an effort. There was always a semi-legal still on a naval vessel, producing alcohol that was barely suitable for human consumption. It was tolerated as long as the operators didn't do anything stupid, but it was generally the XO's responsibility to keep an eye on it.
The captain was not meant to know anything, officially, about the still. But she'd been an XO herself not too long ago. Captain Falcone rose to her feet. "Dismissed," she said as her officers rose. "Mr. XO, please remain a moment." She waited until the conference room was empty, then turned to face him. "I want you to take some rest, too," she said firmly. "You've been pulling double duty since you were assigned to Lightning."
"It's part of the job," William said.
"I know," the captain pointed out. "But you're working yourself to death." William shrugged expressively. A few days of leave would be enough to go to the I&I station, or perhaps a more expensive holiday on Tyre if he'd felt like stretching his legs. Or he could have gotten a hotel room and just slept for several days. Or found someone young, female, and willing to share his bed. But a day wasn't enough to do anything, apart from relaxing in his cabin or watching entertainment flicks. He hadn't been brought up to be lazy.
"If that's an order," he said. "I will obey, but..."
"It is an order," Captain Falcone said. There was a thin smile on her face. She'd probably been very like him when she'd been an XO. "Get some rest, Bill. You need it." "Bill," William repeated. The nickname brought back bad memories. His brother had always called him Bill. Or worse.
"Please just call me William, Captain."
The captain gave him a sharp look but nodded. "Get some rest, William," she repeated. "I think there will be little time for resting when we're on our way." William saluted, then left the compartment. The hatch hissed closed behind him. Outside, he stopped and considered, briefly. He'd worried about the captain. He knew he had good reason to worry about the captain. But perhaps he'd been wrong. Perhaps it wouldn't be so bad after all. Chapter 6. The bridge looked and felt different as Kat stepped through the hatch and walked towards her command chair. All of the consoles were manned this time, each one installed, then checked and checked again until the engineers were absolutely certain they were working perfectly. She felt the hum of the starship's drives, a constant background noise ever since the fusion plants had been activated for the first time, grow stronger as the chief engineer ran his final checks. Lightning was finally ready to separate herself from the shipyard and head into deep space. Kat settled back in her command chair, trying to control the mounting excitement within her heart. This was her ship. She'd sat in command chairs before, stood watches, and even held command for days at a time. But none of those ships were hers. Lightning was her ship, and she was finally ready to leave. She forced herself to calm down as she keyed the console and then looked up at the display. Lightning still sat in the midst of the independent shipyard, like a baby attached to her mother. That was about to change. Bracing herself, she activated the internal communicator. "Mr. Lin," she said, formally. "Status report."
"All systems are green, Captain,"
the chief engineer said. She'd had a dozen meetings with him since they'd first met, and he'd impressed her with his competence. At least he didn't seem to be one of the engineers who inflated his estimated repair times to make himself look like a miracle worker.
"Our fusion plants are online, drive harmonics are nominal, and the vortex generator is at optimal readiness."
"Good," Kat said. She looked up at Commander McInley. "Mr. XO?"
"All stations report ready," her XO said.
His face was impassive, but she thought she detected a hint of concern. No one could forget just how much bad luck had struck Lightning's predecessor.
"We are ready to separate from the shipyard."
Kat took a long breath. "Check the tubes, then seal all airlocks," she ordered. No one would be in the tubes now, not after the alert had sounded. But they had to take precautions anyway, just in case.
Besides, overlooking safety precautions was a bad habit. And then prepare to cut the power lines.
Minutes ticked away before the XO spoke again.
Captain, he said formally, all tubes are cleared. The airlocks are sealed.
Cut the power lines, Cat ordered. Previously, her ship had drawn its power from the shipyard's fusion cores. Now, Lightning would be completely reliant on her own reactors for power. Engineering?
These beauties took the strain without even dimming the lights, Lynn pronounced. All power cores are functioning optimally. Battery power is held in reserve.
Cat had to smile. Keeping the lights on was hardly a significant demand, not compared to the ship's drives or weapons. They could have operated the lights through batteries alone for days if necessary. But it was good to know there hadn't been any minor problems.
Disengage from the tubes, she ordered softly, and then prepare to take us out of the yard.
Maneuvering thrusters online, Lieutenant Samuel Weiberg reported. The helmsman looked disgustingly confident in his skills, but he had reason to be.
Drive field generators standing by.
A faint shiver ran through the hull, so faint that Cat wondered if she'd imagined it.
Tubes disengaged, her XO said. We will be clear to depart in 5 minutes.
Cat felt her heartbeat racing in her chest, thumping so loudly that it was a wonder no one else could hear it. Her ship was finally ready to depart. She braced herself, mentally counting down the seconds. Suddenly, she just couldn't wait.
The shipyard just signaled us, Linda Ross reported.
The communications officer looked up from her console, her gaze meeting Cat's.
We are cleared to depart.
Take us out, Cat ordered.
A dull quiver ran through the vessel as the maneuvering thrusters fired, slowly pushing Lightning out of the shipyard and into open space. The quivering grew stronger as the helmsman checked and rechecked his systems, knowing that a single mistake could have disastrous consequences if he didn't catch it in time.
Drive fields were so much simpler, Cat knew as she watched him work. But bringing a drive field up within a shipyard would tear the complex apart. They would have to wait until they were in open space before powering up the drives and leaving the system behind. She watched the display until they were outside the shipyard, and then keyed her console.
Mr. Lin?
Drive nodes are online, the engineer said. You may bring the drives to full power at will.
Cat smiled.
Bring up the drive, she ordered, and then run a full cycle of tests before we go anyway.
Aye, aye, Captain, the helmsman said.
Another quiver, stronger this time, ran through Lightning. The background noise deepened for a long moment, then returned to the steady thrumming that had pervaded the entire ship since the fusion cores were activated.
Drive online. Field active in 20 seconds.
Cat held her breath. This, she remembered, was where Uncanny had suffered her first major systems failure. Her drive nodes had proved utterly unequal to the strain placed on them and blew, one by one, leaving the starship tumbling helplessly through space. After that, she had been mildly surprised the Navy had kept the ship in commission, let alone built a second cruiser to the same, if somewhat modified, specifications. She felt tension rise on the bridge as Lightning quivered, a faint sensation spreading through the hull, then settling down.
Drive field active, 70% power, Weiberg informed her. All systems appear to be handling the strain.
The XO looked relieved. Cat didn't blame him. Apart from the potential for disaster, a repeat of the uncanny debacle would probably have destroyed both of their careers. The last she'd heard, almost everyone who had served on Uncanny as senior officers had left the Navy, although not all of their careers had been blighted. Some had no longer felt like pushing their luck.
Good, Cat said.
She took a breath, then leaned forward.
Bring us up to 100% power. The quivering grew stronger as the ship shook herself down, but the status lights remained green. Lightning wanted to move, Kat realized.